Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Greg, and I'm a compulsive eater and your chairperson for today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose, to extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences, yet unites us in the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Today, we are delighted to have Herb K. visiting us to share his experience, strength, and hope, focused on steps 10, 11, and 12, our way of life. Let's see, 12 steps. Can Diana K. please unmute yourself and read the 12 steps, and there will be a screen share.
Hi there, everybody. I'm Diana K., compulsive eater. The 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous. One, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Diana. I would like now to welcome Herb K. to the group. Good morning, Herb.
Unmute. There we go. My name is Herb, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to this workshop. I'm so honored to be here. Thank you, Joe, for inviting me, and Greg for chairing the meeting and reconnecting after these several, maybe a decade. I left the monastery in 1964. Yep. I studied to be a Catholic priest for 7 years. 7 years of silence. Hard to imagine, actually, that a young man, 17, would leave home and voluntarily go into a cloistered environment for 7 years. I was looking for something, but I didn't find it. I just made a note, and it's the first time actually I've become aware of it, which is kind of interesting. But I got sober in 1984, 20 years later. I went through a lot of seeking between 1957 when I went into the monastery, 1964 when I came out of the monastery, and 1984 when I got sober. All stories for different days. But I awakened in 1988. I didn't know that I was asleep. I got sober in 1984. I went to AA afterwards. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I called him every day. I went to a meeting every day for 4 years, 10 years actually, but for those first 4 years, certainly. I worked the steps on my own, because that was his direction. Read the big book, work the steps, do an autobiographical fourth step, sit with me for a fifth step, and now go do your ninth step. And that's pretty much the instructions I got. I didn't know any better. And I didn't know that he didn't know any better. So I did what, and I was willing to do what I was told. In 1988, I heard a man share, and he talked differently than I'd ever heard any teacher, let alone anybody in AA. He said wise things. I don't remember what he said, but he carried himself in a way that got my attention. He had a light in his eye and he had really good words, but he had a tone in his throat. And the tone, I didn't know it then, but in retrospect, that tone was an invitation, like a Pied Piper. And I asked him, what did he do to get what he got? And he sat down for an hour with me. And after he heard my background, which is an extensive academic background, an extensive self-help background, which included philosophy, psychology, theology, human development, and now 4 years of AA. He said, wow, Herb, wow. You have a lot of information, but you have very little transformation. I really connected to that. And he did that in a public restaurant. And I got it. I have a lot of knowledge from all of my book learning, but none of it had ever connected to my heart, to my feet, to my actions. I had not changed or been changed. He agreed to help me and it took a year. February 1988, pretty much to the end of 1988, to finish the ninth step. And for the very first time, I found what I was looking for, a mechanism and a community that supported change, my change, that I could finally connect to myself and a power other than myself and find out what my life is about. It was an amazing journey. I was going to put my PowerPoints up, but I'm not in it right now. I'm going to stay with you right now. I had a very powerful transformative experience working the steps. What that means is I changed. I became aware in step one of why I'm an alcoholic. Oh, I was an alcoholic. I was convinced of it, but that was because in those first 4 years, I had a lot of drama coming to AA. I had a lot of drama, drunk driving arrests, jails overnight, car accidents, troubles at work, troubles at home, troubles. I had a lot of drama. I must be an alcoholic because I drank too much. Well, it was good enough for me to stay around, but it wasn't good enough for me to change or to be motivated to change. And in 1988, this man took me through the doctor's opinion. And I found out why I'm an alcoholic, because I have a different body. I have a different biology. That was really critically important. But that was the extent of it, though. That was my step one experience at that time. But I saw profoundly that I have no choice. When I begin to drink, I will lose control periodically. I blew by steps two and three because, of course, you know, I'm an ex-monk. I know some stuff. And I did a four-step autobiography because that's what he told me to do. All right. In the past, and this time he asked me to do the steps out of the big book. And the fourth column of the resentment inventory. If you're saying there's no fourth column, Herb, you're right. There is no fourth column. Page 65 has three columns. But there is a final paragraph on page 67 that talks about rounding out the resentment analysis with five questions about self-centeredness. And he called that the fourth column, so that's what I call it. And for the very first time, and I didn't know it when it was happening. I only knew it when I finished the step work by 1989 and I looked back over my shoulder, I could see that I had changed beginning at that moment because the fourth column confronted me with the truth about my responsibility for my thoughts and my feelings, but especially for my behavior. And for the very first time at age 48, I took full 100% responsibility for my behavior. And I began to change thanks to step 6 and 7. In that journey, I won't go into the steps before step 10. I'm just trying to get to it as a context. And so then I finished the 9th step, and I had those promises. I didn't know that I was having any promises until I got there. And he took me through step 10 by having me read the material on pages 84 and 85, highlighting it and outlining it. On my own, I read the 12 and 12, which is a wonderful companion. If you haven't got the and or read the 12 and 12, the Alcoholics Anonymous 12 and 12, it's a strong suggestion that you have it, read it, and keep it as a companion for each of the steps. There are very few instructions in the 12 and 12, but Bill wrote it, published it in 1953. He was almost 20 years sober at the time. And it's a great companion to the Big Book, which he wrote in 1939, because it shares his consciousness and commentary about the steps. And it also clarifies the use of step 10. Maybe I will go to the PowerPoints at this point to talk about step 10, because it really helps. I'm gonna go kind of forward with some of the steps. Don't be concerned about the shooting forward. I would love to have gone over all of these, but it's not important at this point. we're rocketed into the fourth dimension. We enter the world of the spirit, Bill says. All right, I'm gonna go to the Big Book now, because that's where we're starting. And I understand we're gonna read the promises at the at some point in our meeting today, which is just wonderful. There are promises in every step. If you don't know that, make a note of it and take a look at each of the steps and find the promises. The major ones are the promises of step 1 on page 52, unmanageability, that second paragraph about the bedevilments. The promises of step 2 at the end of chapter 4, page 43, Well, at the end of chapter 4, and then the third step promises at the top of page 63, the 5th step promises at the bottom of page 75. Especially the step 3 and step 5 promises are phenomenal, great meditations. But at the end of the ninth step, Bill suggests these promises on page 83 and 84. And then he says, as a paragraph transitioning into step 10, are these extravagant? We think not. Well, the answer is no, they're not extravagant. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize. Please hear that promise. These promises will always manifest in your life, but it's conditional. I'm a Big Book fundamentalist and literalist in the best of senses. I read what's in the Big Book. I try to understand it. I use a dictionary that reveals the meaning of the words at the time Bill was using the words, 1900s, 1935, as well as a current dictionary to see what the translation is today, so that I understand what Bill meant, what the Big Book says, and what he intended. That's really the most important part. What did he intend? Because sometimes the book isn't that clear about what the instructions are, what the suggestions is, what the intentions are. They will always materialize, here's the condition, if we work for them. Then the next paragraph, Bill is a wordsmith. Pay attention to each word, each transition. They will always materialize if we work for them. This thought, if we work for them. Brings us to step 10. Oh, step 10 is the work, but not just step 10, because later on he's going to say, we commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We commenced, we began this way of living, 10, 11, and 12, as we cleaned up the past. So I give the instructions on step 10 and 11 and 12 contiguously to the people who have finished their eighth step and are beginning to do their ninth step. At the very beginning of the ninth step, I give them the instructions on 10, 11, and 12 so that they can incorporate those tools of power while they're doing the ninth step, needing as much power as possible. My interpretation. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Continue to take personal inventory. Well, let's take a look at step 10 itself. What does it say? It says that, continue to take personal inventory. In contrast to step 4, which says, made a searching and fearless moral inventory. Bill's a wordsmith. In step 4, he uses the term moral in contrast to personal in step 10. What does that mean? I don't know. I looked up the word moral and it means value. It's not in contrast to immoral. It's what are my values? What are my beliefs? What are my motives? That's the essence of step 4. But here in step 10, he says personal inventory. Maybe a hint of what he meant is in the 12 and 12. He says, it's a spiritual axiom. Whenever we're disturbed, there's something wrong with me. I heard that in my second year of sobriety. I hadn't done the steps effectively, but it really disturbed me. Well, no, you haven't met my wife. You haven't met my father. You haven't met my mother. You haven't met my bosses. Those are what disturb me, not me. It's a spiritual axiom. Whenever you're disturbed, there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with me. I did not connect to that until I did this work in 1988, where I took that full responsibility for my behavior when I did the fourth column of the resentment inventory. Maybe that's what he means here, though. Personal inventory. Disturbed. It's in the 12 and 12. It's not in the big book. Bill says here, we vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Vigorously do 10, 11, and 12 as we clean up the past. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Bill was using the model, and I use it now, based on his work and also my background in understanding human structure and human behavior. The things that make me specifically human are not that I have a body. A stone has a body, a carrot has a body, a gorilla has a body, all levels of being. But what makes me specifically human? That I have a mind. I know that I know. I can reflect on my thoughts. I can step outside of myself, transcend myself, and watch myself. No other sentient being can do that. I can also make completely voluntary decisions, free will. No other sentient being, based on our knowledge anyway at this point, can do that. Every other being other than human beings are driven by biochemical reactions. We're also driven by biochemical reactions in our body, of course. That's what makes us addicts, that produces the phenomenon of craving. We're driven by biochemical reactions in our minds and our thoughts and our feelings also. That's the limbic system firing for survival, fight, flight, and freeze. But we can transcend that with our cortex and neocortex. And we can self-regulate. We can watch our vegetative state and manage our biology. We can watch our emotional state and manage and regulate our emotions, but only if we're sufficiently conscious. We grow in understanding and effectiveness, understanding of our mind, effectiveness of our will. And Bill says, we're recovered. He says it on the title page. If you have any doubt, read the title page. How many thousands of men and women have recovered? Recovered, past tense. That's not recovering and not recovery. He says here on page 85, we feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality. Hear the words though. We had been placed. That's grace. I don't achieve neutrality because I know better or I do better. I am given the gift of neutrality because I somehow created the preconditions to receive the gift. It's very mysterious to me. The hospital in which my wife was hospitalized in 1984 for her drinking asked me to stop drinking to support her recovery. And I said I would on February 20th, 1984. And the next day is my anniversary. I haven't had a drink nor have wanted a drink since February 21st, 1984. I didn't pray. I didn't want to stop drinking. I didn't know that I had a problem. I didn't go to AA. I did nothing except express willingness. And somehow that was the precondition for grace. I did follow that up with the actions that people were suggesting that I take, not because I had a problem, but to support her problem. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Now, here's where Bill, well, we get physical sobriety. That's the whole connotation of placed in a position of neutrality. Placed, given the grace, in a position of neutrality, that we're not fighting it. Well, in fact, he says that. Let me just read what he says. Safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. The problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. This is the best kept secret in the 12-step rooms. I'm talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my experience. It's the best kept secret. What is entering into the world of the spirit? What does it mean to stay spiritually fit? What are those bedevilments, unmanageability that we're powerless over in step one on page 52? It doesn't mean here that we're not cured from our addiction. It's not connected at all, those terms he says here. We are not cured of alcoholism. That's not in reference to our addiction, the first half of first step, as I interpret it. It's connected to unmanageability, the second half of the first step, which has nothing to do with addiction. That's why there's a dash and not an and. Addiction is a unique problem, 1 out of 10, 5 out of 10, throughout the world, depending on the addiction. But unmanageability is the human condition as I see it. And maybe that's why in the preface to the first edition, the first paragraph in that preface to the first edition, Bill says, our way of living may have its advantages for all. What a prophetic comment. He was addressing this book for alcoholics, but that sentence doesn't mean all alcoholics, and it doesn't even mean all addicts, because he didn't have that consciousness. But he had this intuition that this methodology may be a solution to human suffering, unmanageability. But here he says, we're not cured of alcoholism. We have a daily reprieve. Look it up, reprieve, stay of execution. Yeah. Contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. There's that word again that he had up in the paragraph beforehand. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. And I challenge people in a physical room. What does that mean? Every day is a day we must carry the vision of God's will into our activities. Whose vision? Quite frankly, when I ask it that way, over half of the group says God's vision. I understand it's just wrong, because that's not what it's saying. I don't know what God's vision is, because I can't get metaphorically behind the eyes of God. I believe what Bill is saying here is my vision, which I get out of meditation. Every day is a day when I must do meditation in order to create my vision, my interpretation of God's will for me that day. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. You see, he's talking about here the prayer that he recommends at the end of step 11 on page 88, thy will be done. It's a perfect prayer. Well, in the sense that the words reflect the intention. Prayer is not about words, it's about intention. Thy will be done is a signal that I, with my own free will, am going to be in alignment with my understanding of God's will as it manifests. I'm going to be in alignment with reality as it unfolds, as it evolves in my life. This is the whole purpose of step 10. When I'm disturbed, I'm out of alignment. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. This thought, what's my destiny? What's my invitation? Meditation's purpose is guidance. I'm going to talk a little bit about meditation in a minute. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. Then he gets to the will part. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. The proper use of the mind is meditation. The proper use of the will is principles. Using principles with my free will to guide me in to be in alignment with reality. It's phenomenal. The internal integrity of the big book and its effectiveness in helping us manage our lives. I came to AA unmanageable, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that for 10 years until I did the steps with a third step guide that took me through the steps. I had done them up to that point every 3 years with different men, and I had a different experience. And this man unpacked step one unmanageability by looking at page 52, those bedevilments, to be controlled as if by devils, and the description of that self-centeredness on pages 60 to 62. So back to step 10. We're not cured. We're not cured of our unmanageability. We have a daily reprieve from our addiction. So we have physical sobriety. We have recovered body and mind. We're not using and we're not obsessed with using. But we're not cured because our will is inherently self-centered, and that's the innate flaw of my free will. It's not free. My will always choose me on its own power. So I need a power other than myself to get free. All right, I'm going to go back here just a minute. So I mentioned that we're asleep, dreaming that we're awake. That's not my phrase. It came out of Russia, Gurdjieff, a philosopher named Gurdjieff, 19th century Russian philosopher, said all human beings are asleep, dreaming that they're awake. You see, we have lenses that are colored by our genetics and by our psychology and by our environment and by our family and by our education, etc. Our lenses are distorted. We don't see reality as we are. We see reality as, we don't see reality as it is. We see reality as we are. And I need a new pair of glasses. My emotions that are distorted are disturbed. And when I'm disturbed, I'm creating chaos in my life. But it's the lenses that need to be reground. I need to be able to have clear enough lenses that I be able to see reality as it is. And Bill says that step 10 is the mechanism for following up to step 4. Well, step 4 was those four components: resentment, fear, dishonesty, selfishness. In the 12 and 12, he calls it instincts gone awry, which then breaks the code for us that this is biology and psychology at its best. Fight, flight, and freeze in biology, survival instincts at the brainstem level. Resentment, fear, and dishonesty in the limbic system, in the emotion system. Driven by that root, he calls the root of our problems, selfishness and self-centeredness. Well, then he says, when they crop up. He doesn't say if they crop up. We never transcend our humanity. We improve on a daily basis if we work for them. But if, in fact, we find ourselves disturbed, we take action. This is a summary of the actions recommended in the big book on page 84. First, we pray. Step 10 says it has four components. It's a tool to return to alignment when we're out of alignment. We pray because I'm powerless. We discuss it with somebody, I'm assuming because I'm human. These are a recap of steps 1 through 9. We make an amend if we've created any harm. Sometimes we're just disturbed and we don't create any harm, but more often than not, because I'm disturbed, I'm going to be disturbing those around me. And therefore, I need to repair the damage and also change my behavior, the whole connotation of amends. Flip sides of the same coin. On the one side, a commitment to change my behavior. On the other side, a commitment to repair the damage that comes from my behavior. So I pray, I discuss, I make amend. And then it's wonderful, his insight. Really good psychology. He says, we think about helping somebody else. Resolutely think about helping somebody else. He doesn't actually say we help anybody. The direct antidote to self-centeredness is other-centeredness, as I see it. Other meaning step 11, a relationship with power. Other meaning step 12, a relationship of helping other people, kind of like a spiritual coin. Now, the wonderful part about the 12 and 12 is it confirms when we use it and how we use step 10. There are many people that I believe are confused about when to use and how to use step 10. We don't do it in writing. There's no instruction in the big book or the 12 and 12 that we do step 10 in writing. And we don't do it at night. There's no instruction in the big book. There's some confusion in the 12 and 12 because Bill gets a little bit tangled up in a distinction between steps 10 and 11 in his discussion of step 10. But it's clear from the big book that This is the formula to take action when we're disturbed, as he describes in the 12 and 12. And in the 12 and 12, he uses this wonderful phrase for the 10th step, a spot check inventory. Oh, on the spot. When I'm disturbed, I'm out of alignment, on the spot, I need to get back in alignment. I've been unkind to my secretary. I've been impatient. Now, she's been with me a long time when I was drinking, and now I'm sober. She knows all about it. I go to her and I say, I'm such a jerk. I am so sorry for being impatient. What can I do to make your day a little brighter? And she said, go have lunch. Or she kept food in my in her drawers for me, because sometimes I would get so compulsive about my work, I wouldn't eat. And if I don't eat, I get mean. And I'm talking to the right people. I'm sure you can relate. So it was like that. I went to my boss and I said, you know, I really want to be a better person than I am a lot of times. If you see me misbehave in terms of my relationships with people, or if you hear about it, I would really appreciate it if you would take me aside, close my door, don't embarrass me publicly, but let me know what's going on and how I can kind of straighten it up. You see, I really want to be a better person. Many times I lose track of being a better person and I need help and I hold myself accountable. It worked. My secretary regularly, Herb, you're being a jerk. Or my boss would regularly, I mean, like once a month or two, he would come by and say, can I talk? I go, oh, all right. Another lesson. Yeah. All right. It's kind of like your phone. Most of us keep our phone with us on. And we make decisions as to whether to take a call or not, or make a call or not. But it's a tool that we have in our conscious day. Step 10 is like that. When I become aware that I am disturbed, then I take the action of the 10th step. Now, this isn't in the big book or the 12 and 12. What are the results of that? Well, my experience is the opposite of resentment is forgiveness, where I release them and I am released. The opposite of fear is trust. It's in page 68 in the big book. The opposite, obviously, of dishonesty is honesty, and the opposite of selfishness is love, as I define love. There's a lot of definitions and experiences with that word. It becomes so used that it becomes empty. I looked up the word altruism. The closest word I can come to for the meaning of love as I understand it in the spiritual sense, altruism. Doing something for somebody without any possible benefit for myself. Doing something for somebody without any possible benefit for myself. We use the word unconditional love. Good enough. No human being can be unconditional, because by nature we are conditional. We're finite material beings by definition and nature, by structure, we're conditional. But it's a wonderful vision statement to think about that as our goal, unconditional love, altruism, to be helpful. Anonymously, probably, is the best. I've used the term emotional sobriety for step 10. It's the primary tool for self-regulation, to be conscious of my behavior, and when I get derailed, to get back on the track. This is the mechanism for that. But then what about step 11 and 12? Step 11, Bill says in the step itself, is to improve our conscious contact. Other-centered, as I mentioned earlier, two sides of a coin. Those two discs represent a coin having two sides. Step 12, I use the term enlarge, other-centered meaning other people. And I use the term enlarge because the phrase, the explanation of Jim's relapse in the story on pages 35 to 37 talk about the guy who put a little whiskey in his milk, and it said he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. Well, on the surface of it, when I was going through that story, I thought, oh, maybe he isn't praying. Maybe he isn't meditating. And Bill recommends that if you were a churchgoer, and back in those days, everybody was, he said, maybe he wasn't going to church. Well, that's not what it means at all. Because later on, when I became more familiar with the big book, I saw on page 14 that Bill uses the term enlarge in a very different context, but it explains what he means on page 35. On page 14, at the very, very bottom, he says, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. Oh. Enlarge means extending yourself on earth to help other people, in contrast to extending your heart to the immaterial world in step 11. You could almost say vertical versus horizontal. Bill has a great phrase, I think it's in A Vision for You, where he says, our job now is to keep our head in the clouds and our feet on the ground. That's what I'm talking about here. Enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. This is spiritual sobriety as I see it. Now, I told you I was a monk for 7 years in a monastery. I know some stuff about spirituality and prayer and meditation. And yet when I left the monastery in 1964, I hung up my black robe and didn't meditate again for another 25 years. What's that? Well, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to do it. And I had no value to it until I returned through the steps to step 11 in 1988. And the man had me read and highlight pages 85 to 88. And if you haven't done that, treat yourself. Without any qualification, those 2.5 pages are the most effective description of what and how, what to do, what meditation is, and how to do it, that I've ever come across. And it changed my life. I haven't had a moment's problem with meditation or a lack of consistency with meditation since 1988. My daily morning practice. Now, Bill Haas starts out talking about what to do at night, which is the inventory. And my logic says he should have started in the morning, his suggestions, but he didn't. So why? Well, he's coming off of step 10, which is what we do during the day, but we might miss it because we're so disturbed. We didn't know we were disturbed until at night we're a little bit more at peace and we see, oh, I missed it. I was disturbed and I didn't take care of it. So now I'm going to do inventory at night. Again, it's not in writing. It's at night. It's a quiet meditation. And he has some questions there that you can read on your own or have already, of course. But my favorite part, and for me, the most robust part, is the morning meditation. Bill says, we think about the 24 hours a day and we consider our plans for the day. But first we ask God to direct our thinking. This man said, look up the word meditation, Herb, in a dictionary. I did that. Meditation in my dictionary says directed thinking. Yes, it's not no thinking. It's not quiet time. It's not silence. It's not shutting the mind down, no thought, distance from the mind in emptiness. That's not meditation in the Western culture by Western vocabulary, Western definition. Quite frankly, the people from the East, when they came over, English was their second language. And they called their practice, all of the things I just mentioned, meditation. It's not, it's contemplation. Diametrically different than meditation, at least as I see it. I keep saying that because I'm not an authority. I just have some knowledge and some pretty strong opinions. Meditation is directed thinking, and it makes total sense. Bill came out of the Oxford group. in which they use meditation as the primary source of making conscious contact with power. And they meditated every morning, asking for guidance. Hello? Asking for guidance for the day and power. Listen to how step 11 ends. Praying for the knowledge of God's will. I need my mind to understand and know. But knowing better doesn't mean I do better. So the second half of that is, and the power to carry it out. I need the power for my will to be effective in its decisions. So this man asked me to look up the word meditation in a dictionary, which I did. It was totally revealing to me. And then he unpacked the big book. He said the big book says, upon awakening, we ask God to direct our thinking. This man said, that's a prayer, Herb. Anytime the book suggests that we talk to God, that's a prayer. It goes like this. God, please direct my thinking. Wow, that's really simple. God, please direct my thinking. Then the big book says, we think about our 24 hours a day. He has a second sentence. We consider our plans for the day. He doesn't tell us what those mean. I'm assuming, because it's Bill's style, a literary style, that he is not redundant, that those are two different instructions. He doesn't say that. It's my interpretation. Think about the 24 hours a day is taking a look at my day planner. At least in my imagination. Actually, I literally look at my day planner because sometimes my schedule is complicated. And I review all of the activities that I've got scheduled for the day. Is everything there in balance and in alignment with my understanding of my priorities and God's will for me today? Normally it is. Consider your plans for the days, a different invitation. If, in fact, think about the 24 hours a day ahead is about your behavior, your doing, perhaps consider your plans for the day is about your being. Who am I meant to be today? And I use it to evaluate my day of yesterday, my character defects du jour. Was I kind yesterday? If I was unkind today, I'll be kind. If I was inconsiderate yesterday, today I'll attempt to be considerate. If yesterday I was very scattered because of whatever, today I'll try to be more mindful and focused, more aware of who I am and what my purpose is. Now, all of that's a fine interpretation. It's all in the big book. Here's what's not in the big book. And it was the key that unlocked the door for me for meditation. And that's why I have never had a problem with meditation since. I hope I've teed it up sufficiently that you're really paying attention. We ask God to direct our thinking. God, please direct my thinking. Then we begin thinking. Here's what he said that's not in the big book. We listen to our thinking as the message. We listen to our thinking as the medium of the message. An answer to the prayer, direct my thinking. What am I thinking? What are the thoughts that I'm having? What are the feelings that I'm having? What is the instincts and inspirations that I'm having? This is God speaking to me. I've never heard God speak to me in my ears, but I hear God speak all the time here. At least this is my interpretation of it, that the Spirit speaks here. The translation in many texts about meditation is the wee small voice. It's okay. I used it a long time because it sounds great, but I did a little more diligent research about 5 years ago on it. I'm not a linguist, but I can read other linguists, and that's a bad translation, the wee small voice. The actual translation of the Aramaic is the tiny whispering sound. Oh, I really have to listen carefully and interpret it, because it's a tiny whispering sound. That's why I'm quiet. Quiet time is a great word for the time we spend, but not to be empty. Quite to the contrary, actually, to be full. To be full of God and listening to the tiny whispering sound. All day long to be aware of the presence of God. That's what he says in Appendix 2 in the back of the book, 567, 568. Spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. Awareness of the presence of God is the essence of a spiritual experience. Becoming a lantern is the term I use for it. It's the image I use for sponsorship. What is sponsorship? Oh, I do a workshop on that. But I consider myself a lantern. I'm not a light. I don't have any confusion there. I'm just a channel of the light. I'm a lantern. I'm posted by the side of the trail, the path, the road, to shine the light on the road so others can walk the path in the light of my experience and have their own experience. I'm not trying to have an army of little herbs. That's not my goal at all. I want everybody to be their own lantern, to be a channel of the light, to have a spiritual awakening, a change in the way we think and feel and behave, and it's done to us, not by us, but not without us. This is my definition of a spiritual awakening. It's slow, gradually slow, like a dimmer switch. I use that in contrast to the spiritual experience that Bill Wilson had, that mountaintop mystical phenomenal experience that he had that lasted 20 minutes in terms of a phenomena, but lasted his whole life in terms of a life-changing experience. He was immediately aware that his alcohol problem had been removed forever and that his life's destiny was to carry the message of a spiritual awakening to help people deal with their alcoholism. That's a profound, profound. Page 13 in the big book talks about his working the steps his second or third day in the hospital, and page 14 talks about his spiritual awakening. There's a paragraph in there that gives you this sense of the mountaintop mystical experience that he had. Bill calls it our way of living, our way of life. Steps 10, 11, and 12, our way of life. And in step 12, he talks about carrying the message. It's a wonderful phrase, the first phrase on page, I think it's 79. Page 89. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics, with others. We're all sensitive to pandemic, inoculation, immunization, more than any other time in our life, certainly, internationally. Bill is offering us immunization from our addiction. To carry the message to somebody else. You've heard the phrase, you need to give it away to keep it. It's a paradox. It doesn't make any sense. To the extent that you give it away, it builds in you. That's what he meant by that experience of enlarging your spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. And it's not about necessarily working sponsorship. It's not necessarily working the steps with somebody. It's not even necessarily about being helpful in your own fellowship or any fellowship. It's about having a vision of 24/7 radar screen the horizon of your environment to see where you can contribute. I did a lot of work on happiness some years ago, reviewing all of the studies that had come out of the University of Pittsburgh's positive psychology and Harvard's School of Happiness. The bottom line on all of the research that I read, if you want to be happy and that's your goal, you will never be happy. because happiness is not a product, it's a byproduct. It's a byproduct of your connection to a meaning bigger than yourself and a contribution to humanity around you. Man, does that echo our steps 11 and 12? A connection to a meaning bigger than ourselves, step 11, and an opportunity to contribute to the community around us, step 12. Practicing these principles, certainly in our relationships, chapter 8, certainly in our family, chapter 9, certainly at work, chapter 10. And chapter 11's got a very poetic title, A Vision for You. But when you read it, it's all about providing help in your fellowship and in your community, practicing principles. It's a fancy term, principle. You know, gravity is a principle of physics. Means a law of physics. It's immutable. It doesn't change. If I pick up this pen and drop it to the table, it will drop 100 times out of 100 times. That's the nature of gravity. There are universal principles. Some people call them spiritual principles. I call them human principles. They're every bit as intransigent, immutable, non-negotiable as the law of physics. Fidelity, honesty, simplicity, integrity. Lots of principles. And if we transgress them, life will crush us. This is where the disturbance comes from. We're transgressing some type of principle. Step 12 is all about lighting the path for others. Our way of life is to use step 10 to clear the channel, to use step 11 to fill the channel, and to use step 12 to allow the channel to empty. A very organic process built specifically for us as human beings. I think I'm gonna stop there. I've got more, but I think I wanna stop now. I'm not sure what the time is. I lost track of it, but I'm gonna pause and see what else people wanna talk about.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today. We will now transition into question and answer segment. I'd like to introduce Joanne, who is our moderator for today.
Thank you so much, Greg. Hello, everyone. My name is Joanne. I'm a compulsive eater and the moderator today. Hi, and welcome. Please continue to send me your questions on step 10, 11, and 12 using the chat. You can find me in the chat. I'm listed as moderator Joanne. Please send me your questions. We will try to get through as many as we can today. Our first question, during your share, Herb, you talked about my will always choose me. Mm-hmm. And the question is that a human condition? Yeah. Or is that something to do with being an addict? And can you expand on that?
Yes. I think it's the human condition that's aggravated by our addiction. If I could combine the two parts of the first step. And if you want to spend some time on page 62, at the end of the second paragraph where he's talking about selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problem. He said, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. I am powerless not to be self-centered. This is the human condition. As I'm reading it, this is the human condition. Now, a lot of people grow in their own rite of passage to adulthood to a place where they're not as self-centered, and so they're able to live in comfort in society. I believe addicts are handicapped because we stop our emotional growth at the point where we become addicted to whatever it is we're addicted to.
Thank you, Herb. The next question is about the difference between contemplation and meditation.
Yeah, I'm so glad about that.
Could you describe your process and how
you feel? I won't describe my process, but I will describe what my definition is. There's a on YouTube, there is a 3-hour presentation on what I call intentional consciousness that talks in depth about prayer, meditation, and contemplation, and separates them all out. Prayer is when I'm talking to God. Meditation is when I'm listening, and I'm listening to my thinking as a medium of the message. But contemplation is quite different. It's a sitting detached from your own thoughts in the presence of God. Detached from your own thoughts, awake and aware only of the presence of God, consenting to that energy have its way with you. Sitting in the presence of God like sitting in the sunlight. How much work is it to sit in the sunlight and get a tan? It's a flawed metaphor, but stay with the positive parts of it. I can sit in the sunlight and get a tan by just being exposed to the sunlight. I can sit aware of the presence of God and be transformed. That's contemplation. So the function of the body is to pray. The function of the mind is to think and listen. And the function of the will is an act of love.
Thank you, Herb.
And I can turn that into 3 hours in a heartbeat.
Yeah, well, I haven't got too many questions. So please send the questions through the chat. I've got a question here about step 11, listening to our thinking, to the message. What might that actually look like when we're hearing? How does it? Well, that's the question. Listening to our thinking, to the message.
And there's a fancy word in spirituality called discernment. And what it really means is I'm thinking in the milieu of prayer, the environment of prayer. I'm thinking, trusting that my thinking is a conversation with the power, whatever power with a capital P, that my thinking is being guided. What am I supposed to do today? I have two choices. Go to the right, go to the left. And I discern, well, what's in the best interest of my personal growth as well as my contribution to the whatever? And then I make a choice. Sometimes I make a mistake, but I'm conscious enough to know that I made a mistake, and I'm conscious enough to do course correction more quickly and more effectively if I'm conscious and using step 10 to do the course correction. So it's really about trust beginning. And Bill says it at the end of his instructions on page 88, we become more conscious and we become more efficient in the use of our time because we're not wasting time in dither. Yeah.
Thank you, Herb. I've got a question here about two-way prayer. Can you describe what is that, and is it part of your journey?
Not in the official sense. Two-way prayer is literally the words that are used by the Oxford group to describe their process of posing a question and then listening to the answer and having dialogue and even writing about it as if they're having a conversation with God, but literally writing about it. And no, I don't do that in any formal sense, but it was the training that Bill got in the Oxford group. Dr. Bob Smith, the co-founder, was actually in the Oxford group two and a half years before he ever met Bill, but he didn't know what the problem was. He thought it was knowledge or willpower, that he needed to be just a better or stronger person. And Bill came and said, no, you got all the knowledge you need and you got wonderful willpower. No, you're hopeless and helpless because it's a biological problem. Now, isn't it? I mean, it's so paradoxical that a lay person like Bill is talking to a scientist like Bob, a doctor, and Bill is instructing him about the biology of the problem. But that was Bill's experience, fortunately, the phenomenon of craving. And as soon as Bob heard that from somebody who had experience, he goes, oh my God, of course. All right, wonderful. So Bill stayed there for 3 months with them. And Anne, Bob's wife, was the one that taught them both how to meditate. And they sat in the morning to do this two-way prayer. And part of the Oxford group was, at the end of the meditation practice, they each shared with each other what their messages were, which is pretty powerful also. It got in a little trouble in the Ajra group when people were getting messages for other people and telling them what God wanted for them. That was a problem. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I've got a question here about the power of an unanswered question, which is a phrase. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
One of my favorite experiences. One of my teachers is a Franciscan priest called Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R. And he said, ask the question in the milieu of prayer and hold the question, not bringing to conclusion the answer right away. Just hold the question and allow it to percolate and let the energy of an unanswered question in the milieu of prayer, over time, it might be that day or it might be that month. Sometimes I will hold a question for the entire time I'm doing the step work, as I was instructed to do, have a question at the beginning in terms of a life, destiny experience or decision that we needed to make. I needed to make a decision about my profession in 1988. At the end of the step process, I answered that question. I resigned. Bob didn't have to get me fired. I resigned. At the end of the next process, 3 years later, I wanted a divorce. So I did the steps in 6 months. I wanted to get rid of her. And at the end of the step process, 6 months, I was in a hurry. I saw it again. I'm the problem. She's not the problem. And of course, we were married 52 years until she died three years ago. And the next time, I didn't have any hot poker at my back. But I knew that there was something missing. There was some other. And so I did the steps in a very contemplative way, very quiet pace. Took 2 years to go through the steps. And at the end of that, I knew what my mission was. I knew what my mission was. And that was to do these workshops. I was invited at the end of that process to do workshops. That's no accident. That was an answer to the prayer. And Joe's a big part of that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
The angel.
Thank you. We've got a question here about trauma. And it's talking about trauma affecting us as addicts, being self-centered as a way of protecting ourselves and trauma, and the difficulty in navigating what is a healthy choice and what is a result of my trauma.
Yeah.
How does compassion fit into the Big Book process?
Depends on what you mean by compassion. If you mean self-compassion, I'm not much about that. it's a bit too psychobabble for me. But about compassion for you, I'm all about that, because that I'm a recovered narcissist and I never really considered you until I did this work. And then organically, I began to change and consider that there were other people. I'm sorry, but I have to reveal myself a little bit. But the trauma thing is huge. And that is recognizing what was done and that it was wrong, whatever it was. And it probably changed your life. And it might have impacted the outcome of your life on a permanent, irremediable basis. That's true. And that's where the forgiveness process comes in. Now, that's a spiritual and a psychological journey. At the same time I'm saying all of this, it might mean that you need professional help to navigate the trauma. The Big Book and the 12 steps are not a panacea. They're a very effective spiritual and a human journey for transformation, but you don't go to a priest to fix a broken leg. You go to an orthopedic surgeon. So it's about knowing what the damage is. And if you don't know, go to somebody who can professionally and with experience evaluate the damage. I had to periodically go in and out of therapy during the first 10, 15 years of my recovery to deal with the wrinkles in my personality. The 12 steps opened the door. And the therapy was able to come in and augment, supplement the work that I was doing in the spiritual. I couldn't have done the therapy without this. I tried that earlier. That did not work. But doing this work and then adding the therapy component was magic. I'm not selling, I'm just describing my experience. And some people need medication to deal with trauma or to deal with other kinds of biological issues. Don't be reluctant to talk to professionals about medication. I think in at least in America, in the US, psychiatrists write prescriptions too quickly and people are over-medicated. So I'm telling people, at least in the United States, to go to a addictionologist, which is a medical doctor that is a trained specialist in addiction, and they know about the interaction of medications and the psychological issues that go with it. Yeah, not all doctors are created equal. In the same way, not all sponsors are created equal.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've got a question here just about how long you recommend doing the 11th, how much time in the morning, in the evening do you put aside? Could you talk about that?
Sure. Do what you can, do what you will. If you don't have a practice, start with 1 minute, please. Don't try to do 20 minutes. You'll get discouraged. It's like going to the gym on January 2nd. I'm going to get in shape, and you stay there for 3 hours and you don't go back because you're too sore. Yeah, don't do that. 1 minute of intentional consciousness. Now, notice I didn't say prayer or meditation. I said intentional consciousness. I'm aware of the presence of, you might read, you might write, you might pray in anticipation of that 1 minute, but spend 1 minute after you've read, after you've written, after you've prayed, spend 1 minute listening. What's going on? What's the vibration? What's the sound? What's the invitation? Great question. What's the invitation? I use it every morning at the end of my meditation practice. I say, so what's the invitation today? And I just get quiet. Nothing really happens. Every once in a while, I get a flash or an insight of some kind. It's not about drama. It's not about hearing voices. It's not about feeling feelings. Although, listen to the voices and listen to the feelings. They're all potential. They're all potential sources of wisdom. Yeah.
Thank you, Herb. We've got a question about sponsorship. If a sponsor tells you that God is telling them something that they have to do, like telling the sponsee that it's coming from God.
Yeah, run.
Yeah.
Run.
Can you expand on that a little
bit? Nobody gets messages for me, thank you. Yeah, no, I don't think I need to. I mean, they can express themselves for themselves, but don't tell me you're the antenna for God for me. Thank you. That just doesn't work at all.
Thank you, Herb. We've got a question here. I heard there was a relationship between step 2 and step 10. Can you explain how they're connected? I'm not sure about that. Can you? Yeah.
Sure. Well, step 2 is fundamental. And on page 53, Bill says that as simply and as powerfully as anybody can. God is or God isn't, what is your choice? There it is. Boom. Yes or no? The chapter's we agnostic. Now it's a process coming to that question, and it's a process after that question, but step 2 and step 10 are intricately connected. Because step 10 is the assumption that there is a power that you can call on to become back in alignment, because I'm powerless to be in alignment on my own power. Otherwise, I would stay in alignment. So apparently, I get out of alignment because I get into my selfishness and my self-centeredness, not consciously. I revert. It's a default habit. And then I call on power to realign myself, going from out of alignment to in alignment. This is my favorite gesture. Step 3 is an acknowledgement that I'm out of alignment and I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I'm not turning, listen to the step. I'm not turning my life and my will over to God. That's not what it says. I'm turning my life and my will over to the care of God. It's kind of like your GPS. I put the information into the GPS and then I listen to it. And if I listen to it and take directions, I will get to where I'm going. But my GPS is not running my life. It's a resource for me. So step two is integral to step 10, as is step two integral to step 11. Yeah. Thank you. Great question.
Yeah, thank you, Herb. We've got a question here about family members. It's talking about when you were getting sober and you were making mistakes, like going back into judgmentalism or whatever character defects, and then your family were as well, and you were all getting sober at the same time. Could you describe that process, the daily process?
You mean the circus?
Yeah.
Yeah. The most powerful metaphor was given to us in the hospital program as they were teaching us about the addiction and recovery and the dynamics of it. And they said, you know, those carousels that you put over the baby's crib that have a turn and a little music, and there's like four or five or six or seven moving parts. Well, if you were to take one of the moving parts off, the carousel would go cuddy-wumpus. And as soon as somebody in the family dynamic gets sober, the entire system is thrown off and everybody needs to adjust. So that's the metaphor that I think really describes the patience that's necessary. Fortunately, my wife and I were fellow travelers at the same time. We got sober at the same time. We took to AA at the same time. For some reason, we required our children at that point, 10 to 16, there were three of them, still are, to go to Alateen. And for some reason they went. I don't know what we would have done had they said no, but they said yes, for whatever, probably the entire environment of the, it was a 90-day program with going to that hospital program three nights a week. But in addition to that, we went to a meeting, my wife and I, that in combination to an AA meeting, and right next door was an Al-Anon meeting. And we were able to have, and Mary and I both believed in therapy. So we were in marriage counseling, we were in individual therapy. Every once in a while, the kids went into therapy. So there was a lot of healing going on and a lot of work going on, but there was a lot of chaos. You talk to them, and those first 10 years, they were interesting.
Thank you so much, Herb. I've got a question here about the fourth step being a 10th step being a mini fourth step.
Correct.
And you do, like when you're doing your fourth step, you teach the extended column work.
Yep.
Do you do that as a 10th step as well?
Interesting. Only if I have to for myself and my recommendation. So I remember in 2009, I had a particular situation that had slipped out of my consciousness, and I became aware that I was really deeply resentful of two or three people. And I had to take two or three days out for a weekend and do a column three, column four deep dive into what the issue were. Where was this all coming from? And I did it in writing. I did a fifth step on it, six and seven, eight and nine on it, just as a sort of laser focused work. It wasn't a complete work of all steps. No, I just did a laser focused deep dive into it. And that's the only time I can remember that I had to do that. Because once you've done, and I'm sure Joe, you've had this experience too, traveling this journey with me for 10, 15 years, that once you do a column three, column four over a step four and a step five, and maybe do it more than once, if you went through the steps more than once, you internalize it. So you almost automatically on the spot do a column three, column four, like bam, because you've internalized the dynamic of it, and it doesn't take you long to see where you've misfired, where you're coming from selfishness and self-will. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Herb. We've got a question here about being an atheist or being in a family of atheists. So yeah. How do I navigate coming into my own program and walking my own program when the family have different beliefs?
Yeah, well, it's more difficult. It will probably never be simple, but you are responsible for your own thoughts and your own decisions and your own life. And if you make a decision to have a power other than yourself and be in contrast to your friends and or family, then you probably need not to be talking about that to them. It's none of their business, and their decision and lifestyle is none of your business, and you're better off sort of staying neutral in that. I mean, assertively neutral. You won't get engaged, in other words. Yeah.
Thank you, Herb. So that takes us 5 minutes to the hour. So what we're going to do here, we're going to close the question and answer time and hand back to Greg. When we close the meeting up, we will turn off the recording and open the meeting for questions directly. So if your question, there were lots of questions. I was bombarded with questions, Herb. So if I didn't get to your question, hang around and you'll be able to raise your hand and ask directly.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I will now hand the meeting back to Greg. Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you, Joe. Next meeting, a reminder that A Design for Living Big Book OA is a daily meeting. We are based out of Melbourne, Australia. 6:30 a.m. starts Monday to Friday, and 7:30 a.m. Melbourne time start on Saturday and Sunday. The next monthly step speaker series will be held on the 8th of August, which will be step 9. We hope to see you there. Please check out our website to listen to the previous step speakers and for more information. Located at www.ad4l.info. Today's workshop will be available in a few days via our podcast and through that website. In closing, I would like to thank you all for your service and coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. We will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are those of the individual OA member and Herb, and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together, we do get better. To close the meeting, will Shannon B. please unmute and read the promises, which will be posted in the chat section for people to follow along.
Hi, Shannon B., food addict. The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before you are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they will always materialize if we work for them.